Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Now, the British government has temporarily been banned from concluding its negotiations on the Chagos Islands deal by an injunction granted in the early hours of this morning by a High Court judge. The UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer was due to announce the completion of a treaty today which would give Mauritius sovereignty over the islands, which had been in British hands, and allow the UK and the US to continue using an airbase located on the Pacific Ocean archipelago. But in a dramatic twist, the court is now currently hearing the case taken by two Chagossian women against the Foreign Office. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by George Parker, political editor with the Financial Times. Morning, George.
Morning.
It's another major headache for Keir Starmer. He was meant to be attending a virtual signing ceremony with representatives from the Mauritian government this morning. It had been trailed in advance, this issue of maintaining the British airbase, with the Daily Telegraph, and in the hope to diffuse some of this, and it's all blown up in his face.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary state of affairs. I mean, I think it was basically they were trying to keep it quite under wraps, but as you say, the story broke last night, and that led to this remarkable court ruling at 2:25 a.m. by Mr. Justice Goose in the High Court, who's granted interim relief, as you say, to these two Chagossian women who want to be able to return to live on the islands. And it's thrown the whole signing ceremony, it was going to be a virtual signing ceremony between Keir Starmer and the Mauritian government, into chaos. And as you say, we're now awaiting the results of this court case, which is underway at the moment.
Can you give us a potted history of what this treaty was about, what it was designed to solve, and maybe a bit of a sense about the debate over it in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, the backdrop to this is that the Chagos archipelago was separated from Mauritius back in the 1960s, when Mauritius was still a British colony, and Britain paid Mauritius to take these islands, this remote archipelago. And in the 1960s, they started building a military base with the United States. And it's seen as a vital base. This is called Diego Garcia, of course, on the Chagos Islands, for the Americans in the Indo-Pacific region. And as part of the deal that Keir Starmer has struck, the deal is that we will basically be able to carry on using Diego Garcia base for another 100 years, with an option to extend that for another 40 years. That has been, and in exchange, I should say, for billions of pounds, that's made an extremely controversial deal. Conservatives say, why on earth are we handing over money to Mauritius for something which we already own? There's been a lot of commentary in the media, as you know, when Britain negotiates, Britain surrenders and loses. Is the battle cry of Kemi Badenoch, the Conservative leader. But surprisingly, the deal was given the blessing of Donald Trump, the American president, back in February. So the deal is going ahead. It's been a long-running diplomatic sore, and of course this is the last thing that Keir Starmer needs.
Right. Presumably Donald Trump gave his blessing on the basis that a US airbase could be maintained there, but that seems to be what's at the heart of the legal action. One of the women, Beatrice Pompe, is taken and has successfully got an injunction for. So, I mean, how important are these air bases strategically?
Well, they are absolutely vital, and the Americans see this as a vital place for their long-range bombers, for intelligence in the region, and you know, that's the reason why Britain has agreed this deal with Mauritius. There was some international legal doubt about the status of these islands. And I think that's why Keir Starmer and actually the previous Conservative government agreed that something needed to be sorted out for the foreseeable future, in this case for 100 years with a renewable option. But that means this huge airbase remains on this archipelago, from which the Chagossians were basically evicted back in 1971, an immigration order was issued against the Chagos Islanders, which prevented them from returning to the island. And it's interesting that, you know, some people do, including the two women who brought this legal action, do want to go back to the island. Other members of the Chagossian community, some of them living in the UK, want their rights and status in Britain resolved. So there are lots of different arguments here, but the, you know, this is a really, really complex issue, and of course is wrapped into the whole debate about colonialism and so forth.
Sure, it wasn't a good look, the treatment of those people wasn't a great look for the UK, which is presumably partly why Keir Starmer was keen to conclude this treaty and the Conservative government before him. But you mentioned there this portrayal of this as a surrender on the pages of what might be termed the pro-Brexit press. It comes on foot of the UK's recent signing of or conclusion of a deal with the European Union and talks in that direction, looking at food standards and a number of other issues, which had already stirred up a bit of bother for Keir Starmer, spearheaded to some degree by Nigel Farage, but ably backed up by the Tories and some of the more right-wing elements of the UK press.
Yeah, it's interesting. The EU deal that was struck on Monday, you know, got all the everyone playing all the old tunes of Brexit, as you say, the papers, the Daily Express and the Mail and and so forth were all there sort of with betrayal and surrender on their front pages. I thought what was interesting was that that Reform UK and Nigel Farage has actually been on holiday this week, but they've been actually making less fuss about this than the Conservatives have. And I think the Reform UK have sort of realised the public have sort of moved on from Brexit. They don't want to hear about these old arguments again. And some of the stuff, you know, this language about betrayal and surrender and the revival of, you know, Britain's colonial past by some people on the right, I just wonder whether it's out of step with public opinion. You know, if you look at the opinion polls on Brexit, most people don't care about it as an issue anymore. And there's a certain amount of, well, a huge amount of buyer's remorse about Brexit. You know, some polls suggesting as many as 2 in 3 people in Britain don't think it was a good idea. So I think, you know, there's quite a lot of people fighting battles of the past here, and I'm not sure entirely works in their favour.
Right. I suppose the emblematic issue of fishing, much was made of it. I mean, it is 0.3% of British GDP and the idea of extending European fishing rights for another 12 years. It's those kind of emotive issues, I suppose, the principle of that, that seems to have generated quite the heat. Maybe is it more potent because that issue affects some of the red wall seats for Labour?
Potentially, yeah. Look, I mean, I think fishing represents 0.03%.
I do beg your pardon for misplacing the decimal point, George.
It's an even smaller part of the British economy. It's a tiny... I mean, most of the fishing communities aren't actually necessarily represented by Labour MPs. It is an emotive subject, of course. But, you know, when it comes down to it, 70%, I think, of the fish that are caught in British waters are sent to European markets. We don't actually eat very much of the fish we catch in our waters, funnily enough. We don't seem to like all the sort of the scallops and the sort of megrid and the hake and all those things. We just like eating cod in fish and chip shops. So we send that fish over to European markets, particularly France and Spain. And although the fishermen, yes, will have to share the fish in our waters with European fishermen for another 12 years, it will make it easier for them to export those fish into the fish markets of France and Spain because of this accompanying deal on food standards. So, you know, it's a mixed picture, but in the end, the interests of the British economy are that we need better food relations, trading relationships with the European Union. That will help to bring down food prices in our supermarkets, hopefully help to generate food exports as well. So I'm afraid the fishermen are going to have to live with this deal. And incidentally, they are getting another £350 million from the British government to support their communities. They can't think of an industry which has had quite so much support given its disproportionately small size in the British economy.
Would it be fair to say, though, George, that Keir Starmer hasn't had much luck getting good luck?
Well, you know, you make your own luck in politics, I suppose. He's had a bad first 6 months, I think, as Prime Minister, made lots of unforced errors, including announcing this plan, which we haven't talked about, to cut the winter fuel payments to 10 million pensioners, which yesterday he announced he was having to do a U-turn on. So that was, he's now correcting some of the mistakes he made earlier on. I personally think that he's actually learning on the job. I think he's getting better. I think he's got better people around him in 10 Downing Street. And yes, it's true that, you know, some of the predictable criticism came from the Conservative Party and, you know, the Daily Express and so on about his deal with the EU. That's the third trade deal he's done this month. He did the one, of course, with India earlier this month, then with the United States, now with the EU. All these things, I think most people would see as sensible economic decisions. So yes, I think he's learning on the job, but there are still huge problems facing this government, particularly on the economy. There's no money, huge demands on the public purse, pressure to put up taxes even more. So we're certainly not out of the woods.
Is that all, one might say? Not to be parochial about it, George, but better people around him in Downing Street, is that a euphemism for Cork man Morgan McSweeney being beside him rather than Sue Gray, his previous chief of staff?
Actually, funny, my colleague Jim Pickard and I were just talking about an article we're writing about your Cork man Morgan McSweeney. He's he's
Cork man now, but let's share him as a Cork man. Go on, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm sure your listeners are probably familiar with him, but he's the most powerful person inside Number 10, the Irishman, as he's sometimes known. In fact, there's an excellent book recently.
Yeah, his cousin works for the Irish government here. She's also involved in the political machine for the Irish government.
Ah, well, there you go. Well, yeah. he came in as a sort of campaign guru for Starmer and helped him to win the election. But his role's been transformed into Number 10 as the chief of staff, into someone who's sort of pulling things together. He's sometimes criticised by people in the Labour Party for some of the more what you might call right-leaning policies they've been announcing, whether it's a tougher stance on immigration or cutting the overseas aid budget or being a bit more sceptical about some of the green issues. These are all seen as things that he's doing to try to fend off the threat of Nigel Farage and Reform UK. But I think you can certainly see a more of a professional outlook in Number 10 and certainly more of a grip since he took on that job at the end of last year.
Right. He was kind of cut his teeth in getting rid of the Jeremy Corbyn faction in the Labour Party. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. I mean, he was absolutely ruthless in that task. You know, he was absolutely dedicated to rooting out what he saw as a sort of element of the Labour Party which made them unelectable, the Corbyn faction. And he did it from a grassroots level up, sort of purging them at every level of the party, taking control of all the levers of power in the Labour Party, and essentially transforming the party into the sort of fairly moderate centre-left party we see today. But as I mentioned, there are some on the left of the party who are worried he might take that too far and take the party too far away from its socialist or social democratic roots.
Yeah, he hasn't become much of a lightning rod, because you think this would be, you know, Reform or Tory catnip, you know, the Irishman, I suppose, infiltrating the heart of Britain and potentially leading the charge on, you know, pro-European projects, whether that's true or not, but he would seem to be tabloid gold. And yet he's maintained a very low profile. In some cases, it was difficult for people who were doing articles and features on him and trying to do podcasts on him to even find audio of him speaking, except on relatively obscure topics.
Yeah, he's someone who's not, you know, even within the Westminster bubble, he's not someone who, you know, you see at parties or so on. You snatch pictures of him going in and out of 10 Downing Street. He lives with his partner, who's a Labour MP in Scotland, so he's not sort of part of the sort of London scene, as it were. But you're right, he hasn't become sort of a sort of household name in the way that other advisors in the past have been, you know, most notably someone like Alistair Campbell, for example, back in the days of Tony Blair. He operates much more behind the scenes, but that isn't to diminish his influence. He's highly influential. He was involved in the EU negotiations, but I don't think anyone's made the suggestion that he's some sort of Irish fifth columnist trying to secretly reverse Brexit. I think it's, frankly, common sense economics and politics for Keir Starmer.
Right. Cork men are known for their humility and understatedness. I say that with my tongue firmly in my cheek, and no offence to Cork people. George Parker, thanks very much for joining us. Back in a minute.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.